I am thoroughly heterosexual, but I do understand that given the right experiences, given different context, given different values, that I could easily be a lesbian.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKinsey Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
Last week we tackled some pretty big subjects. We talked about birth control and we talked about abortion. And here we are again today. We're going to tackle another really big one in our series on sexuality, and that is homosexuality. So right from the very beginning, I'm going to pass the ball to your court and let you introduce us to this subject.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that the thing that we have to come to terms with is something that we introduced last week and developed a little bit, and that is the whole question of, can we know something about what God is up to and what God has purposed and what God has intended, not merely from the Bible, but from the natural order, the structure of reality, the structure of the cosmos as God made it. And I'm arguing that we can, that I think that's an important resource for us as Christians.
Now, what can we do? Let me see if I'm hearing you correctly, that there are some things that the Bible just doesn't talk about explicitly, mm-hmm. and that I must use my eyes to look around at how the world has been created, look at its order, and glean from it some understanding, some wisdom about how God intended things to be.
Right, right. Let me just take an obvious example just to illustrate what I'm talking about. The Bible does say love one another, for example, but I'm not aware that the Bible ever commands us to not dig our fingernails deeply into somebody's forearm, for example. It doesn't explicitly command us not to do that, causing pain. Well, why does it not have to do that? Because it's life experience itself that teaches us that would be painful, and to do that to another human being would be cruel. You know, don't drive spikes through people's thighs. Well, why? How do I know not to do that? Because I have enough life experience to know that that is both a painful and a destructive thing to do to another human being. So, under the general category of love your neighbor, I can come to understand that those are things I shouldn't do.
It just follows.
Yeah. Because of life experience and because of nature and because of physical reality and what I have come to understand about those things. So we can't discount the knowledge that we gain just by living life and having experience and studying the physical world. That's all very relevant and useful information for knowing how to live a godly life. I wouldn't know how to live a godly life without drawing upon that information. So that's an important resource.
So that's part of the information that we need to bring with us when we're thinking about the area of homosexuality.
Right. So, let's look at reality. Let's look at God's design, nature. How, if we look at just male and female anatomy, physiology, biology, and so on, I think it is transparent. I think it is obvious that God intended male and female to marry one another, to celebrate their commitment sexually, to procreate, bring children into the world, and so on. I mean, I really don't think it's even debatable whether that's what the Creator intended or not. It just seems as clear as day to me that that's what He intended. We live in a time, however, where, you know, someone may come along and say, well, why couldn't God have made it so that males marry males and women marry women? And, you know, maybe some men would marry men and some men would marry women. Enough men would marry women to keep the race going, but that it would be just as valid for men to live in a loving, committed relationship with each other and women to live in a loving, committed relationship to each other. Why couldn't God have done that?
Well, that's exactly what is being said today.
The problem is that the question is kind of... the question is a bogus question to start with. I mean, there's no answer to the question, why couldn't he have, other than to say, well, sure, he could have. You know, it's logically possible that God could have created a world that involved both homosexuality and bisexuality. It's logically possible that he could have done that.
But did he do that?
But the question is, did he do that? What is the reality we live in, not what could have the reality have been, or what would be a possible reality? And did he create the world where heterosexuality and homosexuality coexist? Two things suggest that he didn't. One, I think, is the natural order itself. There really doesn't seem... our bodies are made for heterosexuality physiologically. And then when you come to the scriptures, the Bible itself assumes a worldview that simply takes it for granted that heterosexuality, heterosexual marriages are God's intention, God's purpose, God's goal for making the sexual creatures at all. And then you have explicit prohibitions for homosexuality in the law and in the New Testament as well. So I think the evidence is overwhelming for Christians that whatever God might have done, he didn't create a world other than the world that we live in where heterosexual marriage is the norm for how we are to live as sexual beings.
So a lot of people would argue with you, though, on all three of those points, but let's go to the evidence from the Bible.
In the beginning, you have in Genesis the account of the creation, which is an account explaining the difference between the sexes, explaining the creation of man and woman. You have it stated that the woman was created, and therefore, because the woman was created, a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. In this account that's kind of setting the stage, describing human history, describing human realities, describing human experience, you have an explicit reference to heterosexual marriage. You don't even have a whisper to suggest anything like homosexual marriage. So right from the beginning, you have the assumption of heterosexual marriage. Then you go to the Mosaic Law, and you have statements like, for a male to lie with a male is an abomination. And there's a number of passages that say similar things to that. You get into the New Testament, and Paul says to the Corinthians, some of you were perjurers, liars, murderers, homosexuals, effeminate, something else, but you were washed, you were sanctified. He goes on to say, that is, although that had been their commitments, that had been their lifestyle, that had been the reality that they had given themselves over to, and when God came into their life to sanctify them and to set them apart, he transformed their attitudes and their perceptions and their values, and they repudiated the very lifestyle that they had been pursuing prior to their conversion. Just, and I suppose there's other things that we could look at, but the pattern throughout from beginning to end is to see homosexuality as an attempt on our part to reinvent sexuality, to make it something, to pretend that it's something that God didn't make it to be, and to pursue our life in the light of that pretense, in the light of that fantasy and that play acting that we're doing, instead of trying to come to terms with, what does God want me to do as a male, or what does God want me to do as a female in the world? How does he want me to conduct myself, and what choices does he want me to make, and how does he want me to live in the light of the reality of the world he made? Instead of asking those questions, we pursue, what do I think I would want, and let me pretend like that's reality and let me live my life that way. And we talked about that last week. I mean, that's the fundamental attitude of really all sin and all evil, is wanting to reject reality and rewrite my own one way or the other.
What people might say when they're listening to this is, you know, Jack is just homophobic, and that's where it comes from.
Well, of course, homophobic has lost all meaning. I don't think people mean by it what someone like Freud would have meant by it. So we have to, you know, I'd want to know, what are you talking about? What do you mean? if you mean I think homosexuality is sin, then okay, if that's what homophobic means, then I'm homophobic. I think the Bible teaches that homosexuality is a transgression of the world that God made. If they think that I'm afraid of some homosexual tendencies in me and that I'm just trying to deal with my fear of those by kind of pretending to take the high moral ground and repudiate it, that's just simply not true. I know that I could be a homosexual, and I will admit that right up front. I think I understand myself well enough to know how easy it would be to find homosexuality intriguing and convenient. And if I had made a different set of choices in my life, I could easily be in that lifestyle, defending that lifestyle, trying to rationalize that lifestyle. I would be fully capable of doing that. And am I afraid of that? No, I'm not afraid of that any more than I'm afraid of any of the other evil that I see within me. In the one sense, I'm afraid of it all because I realize how powerful it is, but I'm not afraid of it in the sense that I recognize that's what God is going to save me from and protect me from and is in the process of reorienting my attitudes toward, giving me a heart that will repudiate my own sinfulness.
I bet you just shocked a lot of people by what you just said, Jack, that you would be willing on the radio to say that I could see myself as a homosexual. It could be possible that that would have been a road that I would have gone down.
Well, it's the truth. And I think it's the truth for every other male that I know. I can't speak for females, but for every other male that I know, because I know how easy it would be for me to give myself over to sensuality. And in the final analysis, I think that's what homosexuality is all about. It's about becoming obsessed and preoccupied with the physical pleasure of sex, with orgasm as such, and losing all perspective on what the sexual relationship is supposed to be all about. And then asking, what kind of sexual adventure can I go down to get greater and greater pleasure? What kind of variety can I have in my life? How can I heighten pleasure and so on? And seeing no moral responsibility, seeing no moral boundaries, seeing no moral dimension to sexuality, so that anything is possible and anything is permissible. If one were to allow themselves to think in those terms, then I don't think there's any end to where someone would go. And that's where I would go as well, if I believed different things about this world. Because I know the tug of just raw, straightforward physical passion. I know what that feels like. I know the force, I know the pressure, I know the drive that's there. And if I am not in a position to decide that I'm the one who needs to control that and I need to put that within moral boundaries, then where would it take me? It would take me anywhere. There would be no place where it wouldn't go.
And Jack, couple that with the tug, the need for emotional connectedness.
Right.
Find a person who really doesn't know how to connect to people or hasn't well, and then find somebody of their own sex that they connect well with. The sexual component of emotional relationship can come out quite quickly.
Right.
And does often, especially in the context of just a real secure emotional environment. And that, in two ways, that really fits the homosexual drive, I guess I want to say, because there really is a huge support structure for both gays and lesbians. It's incredible. They're a group who has been tormented, and so they pull together in their suffering. And there is a great deal then of support in that way. Also, you often hear jokes about men and not being able to understand women. I'll tell you a joke I heard not long ago, and I think it really fits what a lot of men, what I hear a lot of men say. One time a man found a genie, and the genie said, I'll shorten this, what would you like? And he said, well, you know, what I've always wanted was to go to Hawaii, but I'm afraid to go across the ocean. I'm afraid of the water, and I'm afraid of the air, so I can never get across. Will you build a road across for me? And the genie said, oh, Do you know what a problem that would be for the shipping lines? It would just really create a problem. I really don't usually turn people down, but I think I'm going to have to turn you down on this one. And the guy said, oh, I'm really disappointed. But there is something else that I really have wanted. I just don't understand women. Could you help me understand? And the genie said, how many lanes do you want to... So what they were saying, of course, was women are really difficult to understand. So in the homosexual culture, women have a difficult time understanding men as well. And men have a hard time, of course, understanding women. And so I think it's very much of a draw to be in a homosexual relationship where I just kind of naturally understand what somebody of my own sex is like a lot better than the work of trying to understand somebody of the opposite sex.
Yeah, exactly. And the problem, therefore, of homosexuality, given the view of marriage that we've been presenting over the last several weeks, is that it short-circuits what God had in mind. That what God had in mind is for people who are hard to understand, to take a person who's hard to understand because they're fundamentally different than me, a woman to a man and a man to a woman, and take on the commitment of getting to know them. That's the school, the classroom that God wanted me to take on. And in a homosexual relationship, I say no to that. That's too hard. Let me do something easier instead. Years ago, I think this was probably in the early 70s, I saw a documentary on a San Francisco television station about male homosexuality. And basically it was this, they had taken these interviews with male homosexuals in San Francisco and would just let them speak, tell their own story, unedited, uncut, for long periods of time. It was very, very enlightening to me because there was one theme that just kept coming up over and over and over again. It was the universal message of the program. Why am I a homosexual? Well, yeah, I tried to have sexual relationships with women, but it was just too complicated. And they talked a lot about the game playing. There's all kinds of game playing there. But with other men, it's just really straightforward. It's just it's really a whole lot easier, a whole lot smoother. The relationships go a lot better. And reading between the lines, I realized exactly what you just said. What they've confronted is the reality that women are different than them. They don't know how they think. They don't know how they look at the world. They don't know what's important to them instinctively. They would have to work at getting to know that. They'd have to know them better. And so it became very hard. It became difficult waters to navigate. Over here with their male friend, they understand them. They know what they want. They want the same things. They are interested in the same sorts of things, not as individuals, but as men. And so it was just a whole lot easier relationship. So let's forget the hard stuff. Let's just go with what's easy.
But isn't that what our culture always is encouraging us to do, or very often, is why go for the hard stuff? And we really have to have an understanding of that the answer to that question, to want to pursue a lot of what God has intended our lives to be about. We have to be willing to embrace the reality of suffering, the reality of not always feeling comfortable, to grow up, to mature.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And if we don't have that desire, or we don't understand what that means, we really don't have much of a reason to not pursue what I want, whenever I want it.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what we have to understand as Christians, is given a rejection of what life is really all about, there's a lot of things in this world that's happening around us that are very understandable. They make a lot of sense, and homosexuality is one of them. I can be very empathetic. I can be very sympathetic with the choice to be a homosexual. I understand where it's coming from. I understand the confusion that out of which it is coming. I don't agree with it. I don't think it's honorable. I don't think it's right. I don't think it's good. I think it is perverse in the same way that much of what I do is perverse, a real distortion of what God had in mind for the way I would think and behave and act and so on. And I think we shouldn't hesitate to recognize that it's a perversion. But it's no more perverse than many of the things in my life. And I need to therefore understand it in those terms.
Perverse
and
like
rather
what?
Rather than make myself feel superior because of I haven't chosen that lifestyle, I need to I need to be empathetic that there goes sin one more time, and there I could be if it weren't for different experiences and different choices that I made in my life. But I'm no different than they are. They're just manifesting their sin that way. I manifest my sin another way, but sin is the enemy of us both. Sin in me and sin in them is our common enemy. And oh, that we could be freed from that enemy.
What you're saying here, Jack, is not that homosexuality is perverse in a bigger way than other sins that we might involve ourselves in?
Right, exactly. I think that is an attitude that Christians get sometimes, is that homosexuality is kind of the most awful, the most terrible sin that anyone could ever commit. I don't think that's the Bible's perspective. When Paul, in Romans 1, he talks about the rebellion against God, the rejection of God, the not honoring God as God and not giving thanks, not being duly grateful to God, and he eventually brings up the issue of homosexuality. Sometimes people read that as kind of a progression into deeper and deeper perversion, or deeper and deeper sinfulness, or a kind of a spiral down to the depths of depravity, and that when you get to the bottom there's homosexuality. But I really don't think that's the right way to read that passage and what Paul is doing in that passage. I think what Paul finds remarkable about homosexuality is not that it is more perverse than the other things that we do, because all of our lives are perverse as natural-born sinners. My self-centeredness is perverse. My sense of entitlement is perverse. My lust for power and fame and glory is perverse. My hatred toward other people is perverse. And we could go right on down the list. All of that stuff is a distortion of what it means to be a human being. It's a grotesque facsimile of humanity. It's not humanity as God intended it to be, and in that sense is a perversion. Well, homosexuality is a perversion among perversions. That's true. But I think what the reason Paul uses the example of homosexuality is not that it's more greatly perverse, but that it's more obviously perverse. When I am an impatient, manipulative, coercive husband and father, that's perverse, but it seems so natural to us. I mean, we live with it every day. It's subtle. It's kind of hidden.
And usually your family sees it, but the outside world does not.
The outside world does not see it, yeah.
So you can look like a real nice guy out here. And
right. So it's relatively invisible to us. And it, not only to me, but also relatively invisible to other people. Homosexuality is my perversion flaunted. I mean, I'm sort of out there with my perversion, in the sense that if I were looking at the world the way I ought to be looking at the world, it ought to be obvious to everyone concerned that homosexuality is not what God had in mind when he created sexuality. The things I was mentioning earlier about physiologically, anatomically, biologically, just the whole reality of the given biology of human beings should tell me, oh, I see how God wanted this to work. He wanted men to marry women and have children and live together as families. That's what God had in mind. That ought to be obvious to us. The fact that it's not speaks volumes about how willing we are to blind ourselves to the truth. Since it ought to be obvious to us, it ought to be obvious to us that homosexuality is a perversion of what God had in mind, and therefore a manifestation of our basically rebellious heart. But that same rebellion manifests itself over and over again in tons of different ways, and all of us experience it at one level or another. We're all equally perverse.
But we just don't redefine our homosexuality as being good. I think implicit in what you're saying is that we're redefining most of our behavior that really is wrong, evil, perverse, and making it okay. And then putting ourselves as Christians perhaps on higher ground and saying, but I don't commit adultery, but I'm not a homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of sexual sins, I don't do those things. But what we overlook, and this is a really important point, and I'm afraid that it's not going to be understood, because I know I wouldn't have gotten it too long ago, not at the depth that I understand it today, is that my own my my sense of superiority in looking at these people as being worse than me is as perverse as the homosexuality itself. Me saying that I'm better than is my perversion.
Exactly. And we reframe that and redefine that, like you say, because we look at that and say that I am morally better than them, which in fact, in reality, is my own self-deception. But instead of calling it self-deception, we say it's righteousness or it's a strong commitment to morality or something like that. We're looking at something that we ought to be ashamed of, my self-deception, and we're turning it into something that I find is a virtue that I'm proud of instead. Well, that's exactly what the homosexual is doing. They're taking something that they ought to be ashamed of, their rebellion against the created order as God has made it, and their rebellious attempt to redefine their sexuality. They ought to be ashamed of that rebellion, but instead they turn it into a point of virtue and pride for themselves.
An argument that lots of homosexuals, though, would use, Jack, is that they didn't become a homosexual. They were made that way.
Yeah, that. Speaking of genetics, for example, I mean, that they assume that there's some sort of genetic predisposition or something.
They never experienced it as a decision. They just grew up knowing they were gay.
Yeah. Well, that's not real compelling to me, and for a number of reasons. First of all, if I look at my own experience, I don't remember ever choosing to be a liar. It came pretty naturally to me. I don't ever remember choosing to be self-centered. It came pretty naturally to me. I don't ever remember choosing to be thoughtless and cruel, but I just kind of fell into it. It just sort of developed as I grew older. I became thoughtless and cruel to people. And yet, in all of those cases, the Bible looks at that and asks me to consider, don't you think, however, that that's a perversion of what it means to be a human being? Regardless of how naturally it may have come about in your life, the fact that you didn't consciously, deliberately, out of some kind of existential crisis, choose it for yourself doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it good. It doesn't make it noble. It doesn't make it in keeping with God's ideal for what it means to be a human being. It's still wrong, regardless of how naturally it seemed to have arisen in your experience. Now, the difference, of course, may be that we think of sexual orientation as being somehow instinctual and natural. But as I said before, just from my own experience, I recognize how easy it would be if I redefined my sexuality and refocused my sexuality, taking it out of moral boundaries. It would be very easy for me to take anything as a sexual partner or a sexual object. If I'm only interested in physical gratification and relationship is completely out of the equation, then what difference would it make? You know, take something like sexual fantasy, pornography. That's simply a preoccupation with arousal, orgasm, physical gratification, the adrenaline high. That's simply physical pleasure that somebody is pursuing. And the pictures, the movie, the language, the ideas are a prop to pursuing physical pleasure. Can another person become a prop to pursuing physical pleasure? I think human experience says yes, absolutely. There's no question about that. And then when you add to it the other dimension that a physical person can also give a kind of feeling of connectedness, a kind of pretense of commitment and relationship and so on, those are really, really attractive things to people. But they have nothing to do with the reality of one human being making a moral, responsible commitment to another human being. If I discount that and say that that has nothing to do with me, I don't want that to be a part of the way I use my sexuality, then any of us could go there. Now, I think I am as thoroughly heterosexual as anybody I know in my orientation, whatever that means. I am as thoroughly heterosexual as you can get. So if we're going to talk about it at a genetic level, I must have the genes for heterosexuality, and yet I can imagine myself very easily being homosexual. Well, given that that's the case, the whole argument that we just are kind of automatically programmed by our genes to be one or the other makes no sense to me in my experience. because I don't care what genes you give me. I understand human beings. I understand what drives human beings, and I could be there. I could have chosen that. I don't feel my genes driving me. I feel my view of reality driving me. I feel my beliefs are what's driving me. My regard or disregard for morality, my regard or disregard for God's purposes, my regard or disregard for whether I want my sexuality to be used in the way that's right and good and appropriate. That's far more important than any gene ever could be in my experience. And that's what I feel. That's how I live my life. That's how I experience my life. And I don't think I'm any different than anybody else.
A couple of thoughts come to mind for me. And I think you may also agree with me that if somebody does feel like they had never made the choice to be gay, that they just had those yearnings, that orientation, since they can remember, that it would indeed, given the reality of what God has said about our sexuality, that we need to be coupled with the opposite sex, that certainly they would struggle. It would be a very huge, huge struggle, because even though they may be willing to embrace the reality of God's creation, they may feel everything in their body that says, I want to go toward male or female toward female. So you're not excluding the struggle in this, and perhaps a lifelong struggle. What you're saying is, but let's not redefine reality. Because it's hard, because it feels natural, because it is natural to go toward perversion, let's not call perversion good.
Right.
An example that I could use in my life is, because I have a tendency toward being angry when I don't get my way that I feel like I'm entitled to, all of those are bad things, I don't redefine it and say that the anger is okay and my entitlement is okay. I need to say that's wrong and work with everything I have against that. Will it continue to be a struggle? I fear that my whole life, that my sense of entitlement will be a struggle for me. My selfishness will be a tremendous struggle for me. Should I work against it? Yeah. Does it create suffering in my life? Absolutely. I'm sure that it must create as much suffering in my life when I look at it clearly, when I'm willing to face into it, as any homosexual would face with their own struggle against their homosexuality. We are both in this tremendous struggle against doing what our sinful nature pulls us toward. It's like a magnet, but we need to work against that. You have said many times in our discussion, Jack, that here today, or a couple of times today, that you could easily see yourself having gone in the direction of homosexuality, that's not a problem for you to see at all. People could be thinking, the audience could be thinking, well, you know, I would never see myself go in that direction. He must not be as thoroughly heterosexual as I am, because I would never consider it. He's just more perverse. So let me maybe clarify what I think you're saying and see if this helps out. Perhaps you've been clear to everybody else, but I've just been sitting here thinking, man, people are going to really argue against that. I don't think that you're saying that you experience the desire for men.
Right, I'm not saying that.
It's not
interesting to me right now in my life. It's not at all interesting.
It's not interesting to you. You don't desire men. But out of your understanding of your very strong pull towards sensuality, that you like the pleasure of your sexuality, and because that's so strong, and if you had been in a context where your sensuality was aroused in the context of other men, why wouldn't you have gone in that direction?
Precisely. Yeah.
And I would say that also for myself. I have absolutely no desire for women. It hasn't been a part of what I was ever interested in. I think that's somewhat uncommon. I talk to so many people who have some kind of attraction toward the same sex. I would say probably most people do, and maybe I'm denying something in myself. But I also can say what you're saying. Given a very different context, perhaps a different family. You know, I grew up in a family where my dad was very, very conservative, and there were lots of, I was in an artist community of Laguna Beach, California, and there were lots of homosexuals around, and it was pretty obvious, even, you know, 40 years ago in that town, where it wasn't in the general population. But I remember looking and thinking that that really wasn't interesting to me at all, and it perplexed me, and I would have said at that time, I couldn't imagine ever being a lesbian. But now, given my greater understanding of sin, I really see how definitely I could have been drawn in that direction. I just didn't have the same experiences, the same teaching, the same, values.
Permission.
Yeah. I didn't. It wasn't there. But I do have a very strong drive toward pleasure. And if that's where I found pleasure, if that's where I had coupled it, I certainly would have gone in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because I think over time, we kind of train ourselves sexually through our experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I am thoroughly trained to be a heterosexual. But what I'm saying is if different choices had been made, different opportunities, different environment, different context, as I was developing into a sexual adult male, then given what I know about the basic underlying drives of me as a human being, I it's totally understandable that I could find that interesting and that I could have gone that direction. So it's a real mistake for us to think that there is something wrong with homosexuals that's not wrong with the rest of us. It's wrong with all of us. We're all in exactly the same boat. Their life has taken a different turn, and theirs is a different story, is all.
It's kind of what flavor of sin.
Exactly, yeah.
Do I have?
Yeah.
Not do I have a flavor of sin, but what areas does it manifest itself? And for you and I, it doesn't happen to manifest itself in the area of homosexuality.
But you had mentioned earlier comparing the perverseness of things. Let me mention one more example. Let's say that you have a husband in a home who is really downright cruel and abusive, and that husband decides that it is his right and his even responsibility to be cruel and abusive because he's the head of the home. And he even goes to the Bible and takes Bible verses that describe him as being the head of his wife and uses that as not only a support and permission to be abusive, but even as calling his abuse a virtue, a good, a moral responsibility that he's carrying out. That's perverse. And it's certainly as perverse as any homosexuality could ever be. That's what we're talking about in terms of the flavor of my sin. Now, that person may be thoroughly heterosexual, but you can't tell me that the homosexual is somehow more perverse than someone who's going to call cruelty good. That's perverse. And we all have our own flavor. We all have ways that we might be tempted to call evil good and to rationalize evil and redefine it and tell ourselves a different story of reality, and we support it from the Bible to rationalize that this is the way the world is, and this thing that otherwise we might be inclined to call good inclined to call evil is really a good thing. That's how desperately wicked our heart is, that we would be willing to tell ourselves another story and find a way to call evil good. That's perversion. And it manifests itself over and over again in all kinds of ways in all of our lives, without exception. There's several... I'm sorry I'm being so disorganized here, but it's a big topic and all kinds of things come to mind. But, you know, the thing about our culture is that in defending homosexuality, our culture also defends promiscuity, at least particularly in the context of male homosexuality. I mean, it seems to me to make a lie out of the whole argument, because it's one thing to say I am genetically predisposed to be a homosexual, therefore don't persecute me. That's one thing. It's another thing to say I ought to be able to have sex with whomever I want, whenever I want, just because I want to, and just have a full-blown promiscuity, ethic of promiscuity. It seems to me that when we look at the promiscuity, we see clearly we're just talking about sensuality. We're not talking about sexual orientation. That's not even the issue. The issue is you want to be able to have sex and sexual pleasure and physical pleasure whenever you want it. Well, it's very clear what the Bible has to say about that. I mean, from a biblical perspective, the restrictions on sexuality are just as severe on a heterosexual who's not married as they are on someone who has some sort of homosexual orientation. That what it says to the heterosexual is, you're not married, then don't have sex. You're not married, then you're not living within a moral environment where it would be appropriate to fulfill your sexual desires and to pursue your sexual desires. It's not saying anything to the homosexual that it's not also saying to the heterosexual. That what it's saying to every human being as a human being is, I don't care what kind of sexual desires you're experiencing, the question you have to ask yourself is, would it be right and proper and appropriate to fulfill them? If the answer is no, don't. If the answer is yes, then enjoy yourself. That's the biblical perspective.
So what we're going back to is something that we've really visited many times, is just the whole area of being willing to accept deprivation in our life. If I feel thoroughly homosexual, and I want to pursue that, and yet it's wrong, then I'm just going to live with deprivation.
Right.
I'm going to hope, perhaps, that things turn around, that things change, so that I can be involved in a healthy heterosexual relationship, but they may not. My choice is to submit to what God gave me and live with that deprivation, to hope that maybe there's a change, or to redefine reality and say, well, you know, I guess God really wanted me just to have pleasure, and he would never not want me to have that, so I'll go for it, or there's nothing wrong with it, and I'll go for it, but redefine reality in some way. But going back to understanding that I'm not going to have everything I want, that I'm going to have to live with some suffering in my life, is a really hard thing to face into.
Yeah.
I have friends, for example, who are single who would very much like to be in a relationship, and it just isn't there for them. They just haven't found a person that is a good marital partner. And so they're living with the deprivation of not being able to be sexual either.
Right. This is not connected. I'm just getting my random thoughts out here. But another thing that has struck me is within our culture, on the one hand, we want to use the mythology of genes and genetic makeup to justify homosexuality. On the other hand, what we really want to find socially acceptable is bisexuality. Now, it's not that genes could not also explain that. That's true that they could. But it just seems to me that bisexuality is more supportive of my view of sexuality than it is the genetic mythology that it's the genes that create our orientations. And especially when you see progress in bisexuality. I mean, what's interesting is genes have been fixed for a long, long time, right? But how interesting it is, the evolution of our attitudes towards sexuality in our culture. They're constantly changing. It's a changing dynamic. As more and more things become permissible, more and more things become interesting to a larger and larger population of people. Well, that doesn't sound like genes to me. That sounds like our practices and our behavior are being driven by our beliefs and the beliefs of our culture.
Our beliefs and our desires that become our beliefs.
Exactly, yeah. And bisexuality is an example of that. I mean, it becomes more and more chic and hip and groovy to be bisexual. The more and more permission people have to be homosexual, then there's going to be this large tendency in our culture to go both ways and have sex with whomever of whatever sex, because that's the chic and hip and groovy thing to do. That's what we're going to see. That's what we are seeing. And that's not genes. I mean, it's just crazy to think that genes is driving that. And finally, one last point. I read a book, very, very interesting book, several years ago by a radical feminist who is not at all sympathetic with Christianity, is not all at all sympathetic with morality. I mean, is not using moral categories at all, particularly, other than fairly, you know, liberal egalitarian socialist ethical values. But it's a book called Exploding the Gene Myth, and she's a geneticist, and her perspective is this whole business about homosexuality being driven by genes is a complete mythology. But it's a mythology that's running fairly deep in our culture, that says that genes basically, you know, like the devil made me do it sort of idea, my genes made me do it, is a mythology that's really prevalent in our culture, that really misunderstands the role that genes play in human experience. Genes really, when it comes right down to it, don't control that much of us as human beings.
You mean our behavior?
Of our behavior, exactly. I mean, and that's what this book was describing, is that my environment is a huge, huge, huge factor. What we as Christians would call our free will is a huge, huge factor in my behavior. And genes only dictate or determine a small portion of what my life and experience and character and personality is. And that's the case that she was making in this book.
And this is a woman that's not necessarily against homosexuality.
And she's not against it at all. She's very much in favor of it.
She's just saying, but we can't say that it comes from our genes.
Right, right. It's a book that I would highly recommend to people who are struggling with that issue, because she really lays the issues out there very well.
So again, what's the name of the book and the
Exploding
author?
Exploding the Gene Myth. I don't remember the name of the author at this point, but the title is Exploding the Gene Myth.
We have talked about this before, referenced it in throughout this hour, but I just want to make it pretty explicit. A question that I had early in my Christian life was, how would I treat a homosexual? You know, what should my response be to them? And I was really pretty perplexed. And so I just wanted to be explicit about that. And it's what I would say to somebody that asked me that question today was the same way that you would respond to me. The same way that you would respond to any other human being. Understanding that they are a sinner. Not minimizing that. Not pretending like it doesn't exist, but relate to them with the same compassion, the same forgiveness, the same mercy, the same kindness that you would any other person.
Yeah.
If the subject comes up, do you think it's right or wrong that I'm a gay person? You need to say the truth and say it with the same compassion that you would want someone to tell you the truth. When you ask, what do you think about my selfishness?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's a lot we can learn about ourselves by seeing sin at work in other people and seeing what lies behind it. We hide from ourselves, but we can see sin at work more clearly in other people sometimes. But the important thing to do is, as we see it at work and see its dynamic at work in other people, recognize that the same thing is happening in me and ask myself the question, where is that happening in me? Who am I really? What's going on there? And if we're willing to turn that lesson about on ourselves, there's a lot of self-understanding that can come about as a result of that.
And there's no place then for self-righteousness. There's
absolutely
no place at all for me to say I'm better than, or I'm other than, or I, you know, anything in that line. I just have to say, wow, I'm just glad that God has had mercy toward me.
We don't like to think of ourselves as fools or as being foolish. Although we might entertain the thought while jesting with our close friends or family, being called a fool doesn't sit well with our vulnerable self-images. The Bible, however, makes it abundantly clear that you and I are members in good standing of a class of beings characterized as foolish. That is the opening paragraph of Wes Hurd's News and Views article, What Kind of Fool Are You? In this article, Wes demonstrates how the Bible draws a line between two kinds of fools. Those who are foolish because they disbelieve the gospel, and those who are fools for Christ. To believe the good news of God's salvation for mankind is to believe in something the world sees as foolish. Believing the gospel often means suffering. It means facing into one's own evil and guilt. It means seeing the death that Christ suffered is a death we all deserve. We might decide to turn from God and seek happiness and success in the world. In God's eyes, this would be true foolishness. So, who are you going to believe? Or more importantly, what kind of fool are you? You can find this article and more at the McKenzie Study Center website, or call and ask for the free copy, 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801.
To try to sum up what we were saying about homosexuality, I think from the biblical perspective, what ought to be obvious is that homosexuality, even homosexual marriage, is not what God had in mind, is not what God intended. That ought to be obvious to us. Granted, I know that it's not necessarily subjective obvious to us, but it ought to be obvious to us. And in the light of that, we need to make our choices and live our lives pursuing what God intended for my life and live within the constraints and the boundaries, the moral boundaries that are there. The right thing being to live as a sexual being in a manner that is consistent with what God intended for my sexuality. What that may mean is that because of past experiences and choices that I've made and so on, I may not have desires that take me in the direction of heterosexual marriage. And if and when that's the case, that may mean that I have to go without any of my sexual desires being met. But that's something that every human being needs to face into in relationship to God, is that I may not have all my desires met, but this existence is not about having my desires met. This existence is about coming to know my God, coming to know myself in relationship to God, gaining the wisdom that comes from that, and preparing myself for an eternity in the kingdom of God where righteousness will reign and where my true fulfillment will be found. But deprivation is really the name of the game for everybody here and now in this life, and sooner or later we all need to face into that.
So with that, we're drawing a close to our whole series on sexuality. I'd like to remind people, though, that we did do a series on marriage and also one on singleness, where we intermixed the idea of sexuality along the way. Where we're discussing today, boy, should we keep on talking about sexuality? There's so much more to say. And in one sense, we've decided no, in a formal way, we're going to end our series here today. But we'd like to extend a welcome for people to write in questions if they have them. They can do it anonymously or put their name on it. And we could then have another show where we are just anonymously addressing questions that people ask. So we encourage you to do that. I guess I'd like to end this series by saying that we've spent a lot of time on sexuality because it's a big subject. It's big in that it's interesting. It's big in that it's a joy. It's big in that it's a struggle. It's a struggle for everybody on the face of this earth. And I would just like to encourage people that when they struggle, that even though other people, lots of other people don't talk about it, that they have a lot of other people in the room with them, and to work hard at understanding and working toward purity in their sexual life.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 405-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.